Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and, in fact, joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Good morning, Mr. Honlein.
Good morning, Nachum.
Well, lots going on. This has been quite a week, and the latest news, if you want to pay careful attention to the AP, it seems that other news agencies are hesitant to report it. The latest news is that the two suspects, one at this point dead, one still on the lam, in the Boston Marathon bombing, are Chechen nationals. With that news being the latest news, what is your reaction?
Well, it reminds us of the global nature of terrorism and that nobody can be complacent, that everybody becomes a victim. People thought this was Israel's problem for decades, and we've discussed this so many times for so many, many years. That the danger of terrorism, when allowed to go unchecked, when people become lackadaisical, law enforcement, others, in terms of controlling the aspects of it that we can, it's not 100% preventable, but we have to go after not only those who are responsible for the act, and too often we're told that it is a lone wolf operation, meaning an individual, or in this case two individuals. They clearly were inspired, instructed, incited at some place, at some time. This is not just something that normal people do. Two young men, probably 20 or 19, carry out such a horrendous, blasphemous attack against innocent civilians that the nature of the attack indicates that they learned to do it online or in some place, and the very fact that we have available this kind of things online should be something that is scrutinized. The fact that in California and New Jersey now they're going to allow people to look at Al-Manar and some of the other websites, some of the other broadcasts where they talk about how to make bombs.
Right. And their brothers, the reports indicate, in fact, the two suspects. Are you suggesting that major cities have a more lackadaisical approach than post 9/11, or in general certain cities or law enforcement agencies are not as adept to this type of work as other major cities are?
Not as vigilant, yes. Certainly not as vigilant as, for instance, New York, where Commissioner Kelly has really taken the lead in making New York as safe as possible. It's not 100% safe, because nobody can do that. Cities can't be hermetically sealed, but the intelligence operation that he set up, having his own people in different key countries and places, including Israel, and yesterday I met the chief of police of Israel, who had spent the day with Commissioner Kelly, talking about the latest information, techniques, tactics, and equipment. As you know, Israel is in the forefront of developing a lot of security equipment, but it learns also from the lessons derived here in the United States and from the New York Police Department in particular.
And we saw in Boston the use of the bomb detonating equipment, or the potential use of it, as they were going through different things that may have been left.
The robots and the,
right,
other things, which
were a lot of Israel connections.
There was also an interesting sideline in the Boston reporting, which got little notice. But the head of the emergency services at Massachusetts General Hospital, which is one of the finest hospitals in the United States and maybe in the world, Dr. Khan was his name, C-O-N-N, and he said he credited Israel with training the hospital's first response team and readying them to deal with a mass casualty incident when they came 2 years ago to set up the disaster team. And he credited that training with their quick response, which people, reporters, noted and commented on. And also, when you see Netanyahu's comment about how in the United States and Israel, at times like this, become one family and are reminded of the common interests and bonds, and that Israel stood with the United States, it's a reminder of, unfortunately, what Israel has learned and developed. But that you obviously won't see
right.
Credit.
And not to minimize what too many families went through this past Monday in Massachusetts, but there have been periods of time when this was happening on an almost daily basis, I hate to remind everybody, in the state of Israel, with numbers even more drastic and hard to believe than what we saw this week. Again, not minimizing what's going on in Massachusetts, but you know exactly what I mean. Also, a couple other things that I would guess other media outlets are not discussing this week regarding this, but curious about your impression. When you heard about the nature of the bomb, the way it was packed with ball bearings and nails, and the intent, the clear intent, in addition to, you know, plain murder, the other clear intents that these terrorists had, the way they created this bomb, did it immediately strike you that it must be international? Do we normally see this type of bomb being aimed at Israelis and others in the Middle East, while the American bomb makers seem to take a more simplistic approach?
Well, it certainly was perfected in the use in Israel, where they put these ball bearings, and finding that they, when the explosion, they come out with a great velocity and great force, and the goal of that and the shrapnel that they put in bombs is to cause damage to people. There's no other reason to do it. It underscores the nature of terror, which is to hurt, to frighten, to intimidate, and to kill. And those who were reluctant to call it an act of terror, it's not terrorism because it has an overseas component. It's terrorism because of the nature, the goal, and the undertaking itself. And this is something, again, unfortunately, which is part of the instruction online and elsewhere about how to make a bomb with a pressure cooker using these added components of the ball bearings and the shrapnel that was included in it, which obviously was responsible for a lot of the deaths and these horrific amputations and things that are necessary. And there's still many people who are in very critical condition in the hospital.
Yeah. All right, so let's say that, in fact, it's true. These are two brothers from Chechnya. We here in the eastern part of the United States, Malcolm, need your expertise to tell us what is it that Chechen nationals might be told or learning or being inculcated with over the years that would cause them to cause this type of attack in the eastern part of the United States?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's strange that the Chechens would attack you. The Chechens are in a rebellion against Russia and have sought independence, and tens of thousands of Chechens were killed by Russian troops, and their target, and they've carried out such outrages in Moscow and in other parts of Russia. They've killed, you know, army officers from Russia. They have murdered and slain and been killed. If you remember the terrible attack on a school,
right,
that took many lives. So it's yet to be explained why they would attack in Boston and what the goal of that was. It's certainly not going to bring sympathy to the cause of the Chechens.
You would think not.
This is, you know, in Chechnya, it's a very involved issue because it's part of the reason Russia cozy up to Iran, and why it's so afraid of any regime change in the Middle East, and many other parts of Russian behavior can be explained sometimes by their obsession about the situation in Chechnya and the potential threat that it poses.
And we should toss
remember,
in.
Remember, this is a Muslim population, and they have been engaged in these activities. And one other thing,
I just want to toss in that Fox is reporting there could be a Turkish connection. So I don't know where that relates in terms of the, you know, the whole Chechenian issue, but is there a relationship?
That would be more likely Kurdish than Chechenian, if that were the case. But I will have to see much more and learn about what was motivating, why they came here, why they would do it there in Boston, the whole nature of it, if it was Chechnya, doesn't add up. But I just want to say one thing, that people who read about these incidents, and the tendency is the next day to forget about it, or 2 days, or 3 days, and everything goes, and life should go back to the way it was, so the terrorists don't have a victory in that regard. But we can't allow the determination to fight this, and the power and the devastation can only be understood if you're there. And as I once was in Israel, and a young colonel came up to me, it happened right outside our hotel, at the gas station next to the Inbal Hotel, which you know,
yeah.
And he said, "You have to come down." I said, no, I don't want to. And he said, "No, you have to." And he made me walk down to this horrific site, and you see the power of it. and you see flesh all over and organs on top of some of the pumps of the gas station, and the bodies laid out, and all I could see was their shoes, and I saw men's shoes and women's shoes and little shoes. And you think about all the families, all of the pain and the suffering that this causes, and you realize the irrationality of it, and the meanness of it, and the horror of it, but also the power of it.
Unbelievable.
And there are people that have traveled from here to Israel who have experienced it firsthand. So obviously many Israelis, obviously, and their families continue to suffer till this day. But there are others that are from this area that have seen this and have experienced it firsthand. What do you make of Middle Eastern traditional terrorist organizations? Let's call them that for a moment. In this case, I'm referring to the Muslim Brotherhood and others who run to deny any connection to the bombing. It would seem that these types of organizations are only anxious to get out there and mention when they're responsible for bombings like this, and you'd think they'd be silent when they're not responsible. Why would the Muslim Brotherhood and others run out to make headlines that they have nothing to do with it?
I think that because they don't want to suffer the consequences, that they don't want to be tarred with something from which they derive no benefit. And right now they are fighting on so many different fronts. And remember, the Muslim Brotherhood, again, is not one voice in one person. There are many Muslim Brotherhoods in each country. They differ. So when a statement like this comes out, it can be a particular leader who doesn't want to suffer the consequences or the wrath that comes in the aftermath of this.
Right, and I think one thing is obvious, that groups like the Muslim Brotherhood are much more afraid of the United States than they are of Israel or others. The U.S. still has that aura about it, I guess.
Where and the U.S. has capacity and
capability.
And capabilities, and in many cases they're trying to cozy up to the U.S. to get continued aid.
Right.
So when you hear a spokesman in Egypt condemning it, or even the Iranians expressing concern, but of course qualify it with comments about the United States and attacks on the U.S.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the morning radio program. Heard and listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Anything else on this episode that pops up in front of us as we speak for the next few minutes, I'll bring it up. But there's so much, even now, Malcolm, already a debate online if they've been living here for a year or 10 years, and where their parents were or weren't, and whether they're Russian or Chechenian. So it looks like this is going to go back and forth for quite a while and not be settled in the next few minutes.
I think so. And the question is, when they came, how did they come in, on what grounds were they admitted? I mean, people will feed this into the immigration argument, into the security argument, the need to step up vigilance. If they had stop and frisk, would they have been able to find this, maybe one of the bombers? And what was the preparation? Why didn't they remove the garbage cans? Why? So many questions that will need to be answered.
By the way, and again, I hate to be trivial, but I was trying to think back. Do you remember a pressure cooker ever used in any of the bombings in Israel?
Yes.
I don't even remember that. I mean, certainly for the suicide bombings, they would not be, right? But I guess in bombing cases where a bag is left somewhere.
Right. This was one of the recommended means because it's easy to get, and it's and once you seal it, it's sealed tight. That's the nature of a pressure cooker.
Right.
So it's a perfect vehicle for this.
You don't think there'll be an effort to ban all pressure cookers in this country, do you?
Not yet.
Because a lot of times, people do react in crazy ways to episodes.
No, I don't think that there'll be a ban.
Yeah, and I'm being
maybe you'll have to sign when you buy one.
Background check. Background check. Do you really make chicken soup in that pressure cooker or not? We need to see your recipe file to see if you're somebody.
You have to get the chefs in the audience.
Exactly, to see if you're really going to use it the way it's supposed to be used. The Defense Department is expected to finalize a $10 billion arms deal with Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE next week that will provide missiles, warplanes, and troop transports to help them counter any future threat from Iran. A week-long visit to the region by Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel will culminate a year of secret negotiations on a deal that congressional officials said will be second only to the almost $30 billion sale of F-15 aircraft to Saudi Arabia announced in 2010. But the delicate balancing act that was necessary in weighing the differing interests of each nation made it among the most complex ever negotiated. Give us the details of the of this deal.
Well, the details aren't all clear yet. What the deal is essentially a sale to Saudi Arabia and to the UAE, and it includes jet aircraft, very sophisticated equipment, and there is an offset to for Israel in terms of Israel getting certain assurances and material, including the offsets, you know, the purchasing agreement, and also that it be extended, as the president said he would do when he was in Israel, about extending the 10-year deal, which, you remember, was negotiated with President Bush, that accelerated and increased the military aid and eliminated the economic aid, which Israel, you know, no longer gets economic aid. It gets only military assistance, but it increases each year. And now we'll have to see what will happen with sequestration. You saw Secretary Kerry yesterday said that Israel's aid would be affected by the sequestration. We don't know what that means. Secretary Hagel, the Secretary of Defense, will be in Israel. I think he left last night, and he will be talking about this deal, but also working to strengthen the military cooperation. There are also Israeli officials coming here during the coming days. The deal, the Israeli component is really meant to help offset the potential impact on Israel's qualitative edge, or I don't even know if that is the right term anymore. It's the term we used to use, maybe on the balance of power, that this will certainly increase Saudi Arabia's capacity with getting these new jets and other equipment.
So what's the linkage here? What one country receives from the U.S. is dependent on how much the other one's getting? Is that what
No. Not usually, but when it comes to Israel and the potential that weapons can fall in the wrong hands and Israel's objection, they know that the members of Congress would not want to see Israel disadvantaged by a sale to a neighboring countries, and I think that is a strong motivation for the administration if they want to get the arms sales package approved, that they throw in these components, and also because they don't want to see Israel's ability to defend itself and to sustain that ability over time as these new jets and other very sophisticated equipment comes into the Middle East, that Israel be able to continue to defend itself.
The UAE and Saudi Arabia could be called upon if an attack on Iran is necessary?
So that question is whether it's purely defensive for Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Saudi Arabia's biggest danger today, and what they say all the time, is Iran. And their greatest fear is Iran. But Iran is already carrying out the war against Saudi Arabia, but not from the air, sometimes by sea, where they harass Saudi shipping. But it's in the Qatif region, the eastern region of Saudi Arabia, where their oil is and where they're inciting the Shiite population. They're fighting Saudi Arabia from Yemen and using the Houthis on the border. So the war is really on, and whether the jets will be what will defend it or not, but they see that, and this is a big infusion of money into the defense industry. And the UAE considers itself vulnerable as well to the Iranian threat.
So now my simpleton exit question, are Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE military allies?
No.
They are not.
Is Israel or is the United States?
No, Israel, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, would you consider them military allies at this point?
No.
Even with these common goals?
The common enemy drives them together, and I have heard from officials from all of these countries that today they have one common enemy, Iran, and we have one hope, and that's Israel. They want Israel to do the job. And are there opportunities? I believe there are. Is there a grounds shift? No. And Saudi Arabia remains often supporting, you know, radical elements, and we see some new leadership emerging. I think may offer new hope, and God willing, one day, if there is a real peace, and if we can address the issue of Iran successfully, it will pave the way to greater opportunities, not only for peace for Israel, but in the region. Saudi Arabia looks at the Muslim Brotherhood with great fear and suspicion, but more because they see them meddling in the UAE and the United Arab Emirates and in Saudi Arabia, and obviously Saudi Arabia is a very juicy target given its huge energy resources.
Well, the military option may be the only option, Malcolm, because a panel of former senior American officials and outside experts, including several who recently left the Obama administration, issued a surprisingly critical assessment of American diplomacy toward Iran on Wednesday, urging President Obama to become far more engaged and to reconsider the likelihood that harsh sanctions will drive Tehran to concessions. This is the New York Times, by the way. In a report issued by the Iran Project, the former diplomats and experts suggested that the sanctions policy, rather than bolstering diplomacy, may be backfiring. As the pressure has increased, the group concluded sanctions have, quote, contributed to an increase in repression and corruption within Iran and, quote, may be sowing the seeds of long-term alienation between the Iranian people and the United States. What was your impression of this expert report?
Well, we have many reports by many experts, and we have organizations that have various interests. If you noticed, there was a case against Trita Parsi and NIAC. They sued somebody and lost when it was asserted that they were representatives or lobbyists of some kind. That was the allegation against them for Iran. So people have different perceptions. Number one, the sanctions are not driving anti-American sentiment in Iran. It's anti-government sentiment. That is, they blame the government for this. They think it's the people who get it and who are paying the price day to day. So I don't believe that is the concern. I think that the people of Iran wanted the United States in the past, especially when they were in the streets in the hundreds of thousands, to take a more bold stand. I think they would like to see them take steps that would remove this burdensome regime. The people, for a long time, the Iran's nuclear program was considered a source of national pride. Now I think more and more they see it as a national burden. People know that they're not going to really benefit. And every week we get the new reports. This week, a group of experts came out with a report about Natanz and how they've upgraded their ability by three times the speed with which they can enrich and put in these IR2 centrifuges, which are twice as fast, and put in more than 600 in the last 3 months. So all the time the negotiations, as in the past, are going on. They're making a mockery of it by continuing to advance. The people suffered in the last week again another huge earthquake, and the government, while responding, cannot respond in full force and doesn't provide the needs. The people are facing sharp increases in the price of food over the period of the sanctions. Mm-hmm. They do impact people, even the regime as well, even if the government can find ways around it and finds a way to continue to sell enough oil to provide for its needs. It doesn't take care of the needs of the people. And they look at these forces that the Basiji and others that carry out the attacks against the people, about the restriction on human rights and freedoms that they have. They're not blaming the United States for it. They are disappointed over the years in the United States' response and in the failure of the West to step up and to speak about any the suffering that they've endured. But that's not what the threat. Now we see.
But wouldn't you agree that repression and corruption are much more obvious when there's a tough economic situation? And in the days when things were better for the typical Iranian, it was not as obvious?
That is true, that when people are facing it, they look, as the Palestinians now talk about the corruption in the PA, and especially with Fayyad's removal. The Iranians have long talked about the corruption of the system. And they look at if you remember the demonstrations after the last election, mm-hmm. the Green Revolt, as it was called, right. People marched and said, we will not die for Hamas, we will not die for Hezbollah, we will die for Iran. They don't want to see all of this investment with Hezbollah. They don't see the benefit. They feel they pay a heavy price for this adventurism, and you see Hezbollah's greater involvement in Syria, the huge investment by Iran. I mean, the millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, even billions that they have spent in Syria over the years. The people look at this and say, "What do we get out of it? We can't afford the bread anymore. The cooking oil goes up. Everything else that is a staple goes up. We see the nuclear programs not being diminished because there's no money, but the people suffer." And I think that's more likely the reaction of people. There is a feeling, a pro-Western feeling amongst many in Iran. The radicalization of the population, you know, the increasing Islamization. Of course, works against it, but they've not been able to squash it.
But are these experts right that the removal of sanctions makes for an easier economic situation for the average Iranian? That's what I want to know.
Absolutely. It would make it easier, but that's part of the reason for the sanctions, is to rouse the populace to see what their government is bringing about, and they have an election coming up in June.
But those in the tyrannical regime don't suffer. They still find a way to get the money.
Well, the government, the income from oil is more than half. The price, the value of the real has dropped immensely. Cost of living up 30-40%. The price of staples is increasing, and there are shortages of certain things. But the government continues to use the money that they get from the illicit arms sales, the oil sales, and other dealings. And in fact, they said that they've increased the oil exports of late. So they continue to have the money for their adventurism and supporting terrorism around the world, and let the people suffer.
Malcolm, when a rocket strikes a lot, is the only difference, let's say, between Sderot and Eilat, that the launching pad for Sderot is in Gaza and the one for Eilat is in the Sinai Desert?
That is, in part, the difference. It also may be a difference in the source of the rocket, meaning which group is responsible or takes responsibility.
Who's responsible this week?
Well, this is Al-Qaeda. This is the Mujahideen Shura Council, which is a Salafist, the jihadist group affiliated with Al-Qaeda, and I've talked so long about what's going on for 2 years about the danger in the Sinai with the collapse after the revolution, mm-hmm. with all their police station burnt, that this has become no man's land, that Al-Qaeda and other groups are operative there, with the influx of weapons from Libya and more sophisticated, and so continuing to come into... I think this is the seventh time that Eilat has been attacked since 2010.
Yeah, but if the Gaza source is relatively, and I'm being careful, quiet over the last couple of months, is it going to increase in the Sinai?
Well, the Sinai, the difference is that Israel can strike back in Gaza more or less at will. It's striking the Sinai is different because there the Egyptian army is operative. And Israel does not want to create, you know, a bigger crisis with Egypt. And military cooperation generally has not been diminished that much. It's been quite good, even in regard to Gaza. And the Sinai, the Egyptian army doesn't have control. But if you recall, there was an incident on the border, and some Egyptians were killed or wounded not long ago. And it causes tremendous problems. So Israel is somewhat restricted, and restricts itself, really, in responding to this kind of attack. There were two more rockets today, but they came from Gaza. But the very fact that you have Al-Qaeda, that you have this increasing capacity, that these two rockets, that one hit a residential area, one in an open area near Eilat, that the Iron Dome was moved down to Eilat.
Wow.
Not fired because the computers projected that they wouldn't do...
Any damage. Wow.
That much damage. But, you know, Israel has to look at each of these fronts, and people come up with easy ideas. This is a very complicated and difficult situation because Egypt and the Egyptian army has no control there, and it's a threat to Egypt as well. It's why they've cracked down more on the Gaza, not because so much of Israel's protection or their agreements with Israel. And you see the Palestinian Authority, by the way, this week announced its budget. It's $1 billion that goes for defense. $1 billion, it's 28% of their budget. 16% goes for education. 28% goes for defense. And that includes $60 million that they pay to terrorists sitting in Israeli jails for murdering Israelis. And this is all coming out of the, quote, foreign aid. And the removal of Fayyad, obviously, is going to be a radical shift.
Is that done already?
Yes, he's out.
It's over.
He quit, but he's been quitting off and on.
Right.
Many.
And now he's
and
gone.
He was, I mean, he is the front, the face to the West. He was saved many times, and I said last week that, you know, his backing by the United States and Europe can be detrimental because they call him a foreign agent. Because he has no real standing, he has no constituency amongst the Palestinian people. When he ran for office, he got less than 1%. And he's been a long-term battle with Abbas, in part because he does go after the kleptocracy and the corruption. And he is the face to the West. Some people say this will, you know, put an end to the progress towards state building because he really did institution building the ground up. Was against the adventurism of Abbas at the United Nations. When I met him the first time, it was because President Bush said, you've really got to meet him, you got to sit down and talk to this guy, he's different than the others. And he was, in fact, different some of the times, but he fell into the trap of, you know, being there at ceremonies honoring terrorists. But he still never got the cred. He had no street cred in the Palestinian Authority. He wasn't a fighter, didn't right. have that background. There are people who say now this will be a test because Hamas always said that Fayyad was an obstacle. They're going to Doha. Hania left already, and I think the PA is going because they're talking about reconciliation talks again. So this will be a test with this obstacle removed. Will they, in fact, move closer? I don't believe that. I think the differences are so deep that it's not likely to be the case. But this is it's one of the factors that will add to, I think, further instability in the region.
Oh, no doubt. We speculated earlier about the ages of these two brothers, the suspects in the Boston bombing. The latest I just saw, 26 and 19. Malcolm, is it becoming more and more obvious, even though he continues to deny it, that the even though the Israeli Prime Minister continues to deny it, that Israel is, in fact, supporting the rebels in Syria?
That Israel is supporting the rebels in Syria?
Yeah, I mean, the BBC had Bibi in an interview, I think, right after the Thatcher funeral, and the way he responded to their claim that Israel is supporting the rebels in Syria, it sounded like one of those mysterious, you know, we're really doing it, but we'd never admit it publicly type of answers.
Okay, so, again, this is a very complicated situation. It requires much more time than we have. There are reports that Israelis met with opposition, Syrian opposition, in Amman. And as you know, Israel's working with Jordan and with some of the Syrian groups because there's a common concern about what happens the day after with the Jordanian and Israeli borders, and that America is training people to go, Syrians to go there and to protect the border. Secondly, the removal of the Syrian army from the Golan areas and the areas nearest to Israel's border, and they are being replaced by various jihadi groups, and perhaps even Al-Qaeda, there are some reports, and others, and we've had some incidents of shooting across the border. But Israel, obviously, is very concerned that either after they finish with Assad, or now this could be a diversion, and one of the things Assad wanted, because if they all focus on Israel, Israel's, you know, set up a hospital on the border and has treated many people. The rebels, though, are increasingly coming into this area, and while they're fighting what has been portrayed as the good fight against Assad, the fact is that most of them are not good guys, and they're jihadists. They're backed by Qatar, by some, by Saudi Arabia, by others, but most of all, their Muslim Brotherhood and their Islamic Jihad. You have al-Nusra playing a bigger and bigger role. This is which announced already that it's al-Qaeda. It's an al-Qaeda group that came out of Iraq, which we knew all along, but now they're called al-Qaeda in Iraq and the Levant, meaning Lebanon, Syria.
Uh-huh.
So you have the forces, the Syrian forces, are being withdrawn more and more to protect Damascus. And because as long as you hold on to that, they believe they can hold on to the country. They also have more and more tensions with Hezbollah on the Lebanon border, and you have more fighting, and Hezbollah sent in 1,200 guys in one day, and they have Iraqis and Pakistanis and others coming to fight. The Hezbollah is patrolling both sides of the border and very concerned about developments inside Lebanon, separate thing, but the Golan could become, and Israel's border could become, either post-Assad or even earlier, a hot point again. And that's what Israel is trying to prevent. And the United States is working with Israel, and obviously with Jordan as well, to minimize the danger and to try to anticipate the problems
and
the problem of all being the chemical weapons.
And in order to prevent that, is it beneficial to align oneself with the rebels in Syria?
Because you don't have a rebel group. You have many rebel groups. They're not even working with one another. They're fighting each other. And you will see that if Assad falls, or more likely withdraws to some enclave, that these groups will start fighting amongst each other.
So
and fighting with Hezbollah and fighting...
So can we say it's worthwhile to align oneself with the rebel group most likely to secure Assad's weapons of mass destruction?
If you could identify it, you might say so.
Exactly.
But it isn't. It's not going to be easy to identify, and it is a great concern, as I said, that the rockets as well as the chemical weapons, and all of them are eyeing these things. The Syrian army is still protecting him, but the forces are being diminished. He still has tremendous power, and the forces, the Alawites and the others, are still loyal to him and rallying around him, and he can withstand and hold out for quite a while, if given his the power he has, and the installations in Damascus are high up, so they're easier to protect, and his forces and with their equipment would be able to withstand probably an assault. I just want to say one other thing that really tells you the priorities of people in the Middle East, that the Arab League, with all the stuff that's going on amongst its members, it's the fight over Syria, which is so, and has just reached its second anniversary, that they have issued a condemnation this week because the British National Library lent a copy of the Balfour Declaration, or the Balfour Declaration of November 2nd, 1917, to be displayed at Tel Aviv's Independence Hall. So you see that no matter all the price, all the thousands of and tens of thousands of murdered people, killed people, yeah, hundreds of thousands of wounded and millions of refugees, still comes back to the bottom line that they can't let Israel have even a copy of the Balfour Declaration.
100%. That's what it's all about, to destroy our history and to obliterate any mention of the right of Israel to exist.
Exactly.
Keep it off display. By the way, I know we have no time for this, but it was Yom HaTzmut this week. And you know, this idea of, as prices to Israel continue to go up, especially during times when tourists want to be in Israel, someone in this new Israeli government has to revisit this issue of subsidized trips for people from the diaspora to the Holy Land. I'm telling you, you know that other religions do it very well. And we just have to increase the corridor of activity between the diaspora and Israel. And this issue must, I would assume this is an issue you've addressed more than once in your career.
Every couple of weeks.
Right.
We address it. But the new minister is very sensitive, Uzi Landau.
So maybe we can make some headway on this.
Oh, and I hope with his leadership we'll be able to address this. And, of course, you have Birthright and other programs.
Right.
Trying to draw young people there, but the cost is high. And the hotels are high, and especially in the seasons when people can go most readily.
But I think when it comes to housing, people are ready to accommodate, and those in Israel are ready to accommodate folks in the diaspora, and that's not the major problem. I think the price of the flights for families continues to be the major problem.
Well, you have an expert travel agent. One of the best in the business, or the best in the business, in my opinion. So we ought to have him on and have him address this this issue, and we'll make him the ambassador to Israel to go and address the concern.
Well, he would appreciate.
But it's not one I take lightly, because I do believe that tourism is much more important than just economy. It builds bridges.
Correct.
It exposes the country. It makes the ties closer.
Encourages people to move there years later.
And once people get exposed, many of them will want to come back, and many of them may want to stay. And look, I see that Secretary Kerry is making regular visits.
Who's subsidizing his trips? Maybe I should go to them.
So maybe we got to get the American government to do a program.
There you go. All right, Malcolm, we'll reconvene 2 weeks from today. Have a wonderful Shabbos, and thank you. Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. In fact, our next weekly update will be 2 weeks from today, which I believe is the first Friday in May. Does that make sense? I believe so. That would be, that would be, let's see, where are we here? Ooh, the first Friday in May is next week already? Oh, no, I'm right, May 3rd. So May 3rd, we'll reconvene and talk about the events of the prior 2 weeks.